Okay, so welcome, I'm Mrs. Chana Glant. So the question is, who is your favorite child? Who's your favorite student? Who's, close your eyes for a minute, who's your favorite camper? So it's easy for me. I'm clearly the favorite of my mother, my mother-in-law, my aunts, my kids. But it's interestingly, a few months ago, a woman, Alicia Turney March, got up on some talk shows, went around saying that she had a favorite child. Her third child was her favorite, and she had reasons why. Her first one was pretty colicky. Her second one came close on the heels of the first. She didn't have so much time. Her third child was came after a break. She had more time to bond with the child. She was able to nurse the child. And her fourth child was a boy. She didn't want a boy. So that was why her third child was her favorite. And she went around, I'm not quite sure why she felt the need to share this with the whole world, but she went around saying, explaining why she felt that she was justified in her third child being her favorite child. So needless to say, the social media backlash came fast and furious. How terrible it is to favor a child, how terrible it is to tell everyone that you're favoring a child. Favorite childs can change over time. You know, why are you ruining your children's life by making this announcement that you have this favorite child? So it's interesting. The psychological studies show that who do we tend to, quote, favor? If you had a picture in your mind, your favorite child, or not that we would necessarily say that, but often we favor children who are easier to parent, right? The ones who are maybe more docile, maybe not the high energy, rambunctious, constantly demanding. Sometimes we favor children who are similar to us. We can all identify, you know, children or students who are more similar to our personality, and we can identify more, relate more to them, maybe spend more quality time with them in ways that are comfortable for us. And sometimes even we find that parents favor children who complement them. So maybe fill in what they're lacking. Maybe I'm a quiet person and my child who's more outgoing can go in to the supermarket for me or can go and ask a question, or the opposite. Sometimes maybe I'm very high energy and my quiet, calm child is the one who I am drawn to because that grounds me in some way. But it's clear from the psychological studies that there are problems inherent in favoritism. From the children who perceive that they are the unfavored child, we have increased rates of depression, increased rates of aggression. We have lower self-confidence. We have often poorer academic performance. Occasionally, we see the opposite extreme, that those unfavored children, the ones who perceive that the parents have disfavored them, go to the extremes of perfectionism, trying to gain that parental approval, which is never coming. And on the other side, the favored children, the children who perceive that they are the favored child, have feelings of entitlement. They often don't do well in relationships as they get older because they have this expectation that they are the favored one for whatever reason that is. So I thought, let's take a look. I don't think we're going to have time in our to look at timely tips from Tanakh, but we'll take a look at two examples, I think, in Sefer Bereishit, where we have this, where we see this image of parents favoring a child. So what's the first one that comes to your mind? Okay, so Yaakov and Yosef, good. And another one? If we had to pick another one, we have parents favoring children. Okay, so the Rivka Yitzchak dynamic with Yaakov and Esav. So let's start with that one just chronologically, and then we'll move on to Yaakov and Yosef. So with Rivka and Yitzchak, we really see this theme of opposites attracting. Because what do we have? We have Rivka, who grew up in the idolatrous house of Betuel, who goes on to love Yaakov. Yaakov, who's the Ishtam Yoshev Olam, who's this, the quote, simple son, by the one who's pure, unadulterated Torah learning. And Yitzchak, who grew up as the Ola Tamima, the one who was sacrificed on the altar of the Mizbeach by Avraham, who identifies with Esav, who's this Ish Tzayid, the one who's going out to the field, the one who's hunting. And we see that they're this really opposite attracting, but we see almost like that each one is kind of identifying with what's missing if from their own upbringing. And then we come to this this whole story of the episode of the Brachot. So it's interesting. Rabbi Menachem Liebtag points out this interesting dynamic between what Bracha was Yitzchak trying to give to Esav. And he points out that we have this concept of Bechira, of being chosen, and the concept of Bracha, of being blessed. And we sometimes confuse the two. Avraham was chosen by Hashem, said, L'darcha natatet haaretz hazot, right? Your children will inherit this land. And then we have the separating off of Yishmael. Ki bi Yitzchak yikarei b'chazara. That only through Yitzchak were we going to have the fulfillment of this prophecy. And then comes along Yitzchak, and Yitzchak doesn't know. He has two sons. Are both of them going to be the development of the nation? Or, are we going to have the splitting off? Is one of them going to be chosen and the other not? So he comes then to the concept of giving a bracha. Now a bracha doesn't necessarily mean to the exclusion of someone else. Noach gave his children brachot, and none of them were going on to create a great nation, but he gave them brachot according to each of their character traits. Yaakov gave his sons brachot at the end of Bereshit, and again, none of them were being separated off. He was simply blessing them according to their own personalities. So when Yitzchak comes up to give Esav a bracha, the bracha that he was giving was not necessarily trying to exclude Yaakov. It wasn't a case of favoritism of trying to exclude the other one. It was simply identifying the strengths of Esav. And what are those strengths of Esav? Esav was a physical hunter. And so what bracha should we give the physical hunter? A physical bracha. A bracha that identifies his strengths, that he was going to be the physical leader of Bnei Yisrael. It's quite possible, and we never get there because, of course, Yitzchak realizes that he gave the bracha to Yaakov. But it's quite possible that there was another bracha coming, right? First he calls Esav, go out, I'll give you a bracha. And then next, the second son, Yaakov, was going to get the spiritual bracha. And that's really what a lot of the Mefarshim assume. That Yitzchak, in spite of his affinity towards Esav, was never trying to kick Yaakov out. However, Rivka, who knew from the beginning of the Parsha, the prophecy, right, that she had gone to the Beis Medrash of Shem Ve'Ever when she was having this rough pregnancy and was told there's going to be two, and the Rav Yavod Sa'ir, the elder one, will serve the younger one. She knew that it wasn't going to be both of them who were going to continue the legacy. She knew that there was going to be the Bechira process. And because of that, she felt the need to intercept. She felt the need to go and give, make sure that Yaakov got not only the spiritual bracha, but the physical bracha as well. And so that's why when she sends Yaakov in, and Yaakov ultimately gets the bracha, when Esav then comes back and says, you know, don't you have another bracha for me? Yitzchak says, I can, right? I gave you the bracha that was meant for you. The other bracha that I have is a spiritual bracha. I can't give that to you. Yitzchak never intended to give a spiritual bracha to Esav. Esav at that point had already married his Yishmaeli wives, right? Which were a source of morat ruach. They were a source of great distress for Yitzchak and Rivka. He never intended to give him a spiritual bracha. He never intended for him to carry on the spiritual legacy. And so he has no bracha left to give him. So when Esav finally begs him three times, he says, please, don't you have anything for me? He gives him a bracha, but the bracha is almost like kind of a backhanded bracha. It's a bracha that when your brother falls, you will be able to be strong against him. But if Yaakov was going to have that spiritual and physical strength, then Esav had no recourse. And so what we have here, and I think this, you know, just to give a small summary of the Yitzchak Rivka piece, is that they each had a son with which they felt an affinity towards, right? Based on maybe their upbringing, based on personalities, based on what they felt was going to complement. But each one was able to transmit that love for their son in a way that the son felt complete in love. It's interesting, if you read through the Parsha, each one refers to their son as Bni, but they never refer to the other son as Bni. So Rivka keeps on referring to Yaakov as Bni, and Yitzchak keeps on referring to Esav as Bni, but they never refer to the other son with that closeness, with that connection of my son. And yet, the fact that each one had that loving relationship with their own child was enough, so to speak, to give that child what they needed to then go on. Now, ultimately, obviously, Esav was quite distraught and was angry at Yaakov, wanted to kill him, etc. But that was because of the Bechira piece. That was because he wasn't the chosen son, as opposed to not being the favored son. In contrast, if we look at the Yaakov Yosef picture, it comes out very different, because here we don't have a Bechira process. Here, Yaakov was meant to, for all of his 12 sons, to continue the nation. And yet, we have this very interesting juxtaposition of the Pesukim. Okay, that right after it says, Vayave Yosef at Dibatam Ra'a al Avihem, that Yosef brought this Dibatam Ra'a, this bad news, or these evil reports about the Bnei Leah to Yaakov. Then the next pasuk is V'Yisrael Ahavet Yosef Mikol Banav, Ki Ben Zekunim Hulo. Yisrael loved Yosef. It's the only time I think we find in Tanakh that it specifically says he loved him more than everyone else, this comparison piece. And V'Asala Ketona Pasim. So he makes him this Ketona Pasim. We typically interpret it as a coat of many colors, right? That's what the kids come home in from nursery school with, this like multicolored coat. Chazal really don't necessarily say it was a coat. A ketonet may really have just been sort of like an armband, like some sort of symbolic demonstration of affection. But it's really unclear what's the connection between this, that he brought bad reports and that's why he loved him. Like why would that endear Yaakov, Yosef to Yaakov? So it's interesting. Rabbi David Rambahan points out, possibly, he posits an interesting idea, which is, it's possible that that Yaakov was really trying to fill a void that Yosef had. And what was that obvious void? What was Yosef missing? What was he lacking? A mother. Yosef was lacking a mother, right? Binyamin obviously was lacking a mother as well, but Binyamin never had a connection with his mother. Binyamin was born in childbirth. Binyamin was born when Rachel died in childbirth. But Yosef, who had a relationship with his mother, a very close relationship with his mother, he tried to protect her from Esav, right? He had this close relationship, and then he was missing that. And then he did, in the house with many mothers, Yosef had no mother. And Yaakov saw that when he comes and brings bad reports about his brothers, he's not doing it because he's an evil child. He's doing it because he feels this lack, he feels this void that he needs to fill. He wants, as we would say, a kid who wants extra attention, right? So he's doing it to get negative attention, but he gets the extra attention. And so Yaakov sees that Yosef needs this attention. So what does he do? He gives it to him. He gives him the extra love. We all know that sometimes we have children, sometimes we have students, sometimes we have, right, people who need that extra degree of love, support. Maybe they're lacking the social skills. Maybe they're lacking the physical skills. Maybe they're, right, they're in a bad place spiritually. They need the extra support. So what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to give it to them. Yosef was right in demonstrating the extra love for him. But where did he go wrong? What was the problem? The problem was not making it clear to the other brothers why he was doing it. And Yaakov assumed that the brothers would figure it out. That they would figure out that Yosef has no mother. And so he's giving him that extra degree of love to support him in that extra way. And he even thought that maybe he's going to say it almost explicitly, or he's going to hint to it. Because what happens? Yosef comes with his dreams, okay? And what is his dreams? Neshemesh v'yareach v'chadasar kochavim mishtachavim li. Right? There's 11 stars, referring to the 11 brothers, and the sun and the moon, referring to his mother and his father. And so they told it to his father, v'yigarbav, and his father got angry at him. And he says, "Machlom azem asher chalamta. What are you dreaming about? Havon avo anivim chavachecha l'shtachav olucha arta. Obviously, it's impossible that me and your mother and your brothers are all going to come and bow down to you. And so it's clear that the dream is not valid, right? It's clear that this dream is simply foolishness. And what he's hinting to the brothers is, this is clearly a boy who's missing his mother, right? So he's dreaming about, he's fantasizing about his mother coming back to him. And so he's hoping that the brothers are going to realize that this extra love that he's giving is really trying to fill the lack, fill the void that Yosef was experiencing. And yet, that was his error, right? Chazal points out, right, that they point out Gemara in Shabbos, that a person should never favor one son over the others, because they said, Mishkal shnei slayim milat, for two slayim of cloth, for two pieces of cloth, which referring to the Ketonah Pasim, that Yaakov gave to Yosef more than the other children. That's why Vayir Javertim L'Mitzrayim. That was the cause for them ultimately going down into Golus. That this degree of favoritism, which wasn't wrong in and of itself, but was wrong in the perception that it created to the brothers, because of that, they ended up going to Golus and Mitzrayim. And Chazal pointed out, what do you mean that's why they went to Galut Mitzrayim? Right? Avram was told that they were going to have an exile. But it's interesting. Avram was told that they were going to have 400 years of exile, which we start counting from Yitzchak. And then they go and have the Sheba, they have the slavery for 210 years. So it's quite possible that they were meant to have more of the time in Eretz Yisrael, that more of that 400 years before they had this redemption process for which they got the Torah, that a greater percentage of that was meant to be while they were living in Eretz Yisrael, and only because of the whole episode with Yosef, who got sent to Mitzrayim, and then the brothers need to come, and then Yaakov needs to come down there, hastened the fact that they were going to be in Mitzrayim, and ultimately lengthened the gullus that they experienced there. And I think that this really teaches us a very strong lesson. If the children feel a parent's love, and they feel that you know, their cup is full, then they don't need to keep on searching, right, keep on grabbing for more love, because they feel that. They don't even mind if another child gets more, because they recognize that the person, sometimes another person leads more. Children don't mind if things are different. They mind if things are unfair. And so if a different child needs more, then a child can understand that as long as they feel the love. And the greatest proof for that we can see is when we come to the parsha of Menashe and Ephraim. Because what happens, we see it's almost like, how could Yaakov do this again? That we have Menashe and Ephraim who are presented before him. Yosef comes and brings them. And the clear, easy thing to do would put the right hand on the older child and the left hand on the younger child. And that was how Yosef set it up for him. There would be no issues of favoritism. There would be nothing about someone getting extra more than they deserve. That's all Yaakov needed to do, was just put his hands down and bless them. But we see that he does, right? Sikela Yidav, he switches his hands to favor Ephraim. And so it's like, why are you doing this again, right? You saw favoritism didn't work. You saw it didn't help to single out a son. But it's interesting, Menashe never gets upset about it. Menashe never turns against Ephraim. Menashe is never upset, right, that they sat next to each other in the Degolim. They were next to each other in Eretz Yisrael. We never have that. Menashe is jealous of Ephraim. And it's interesting, and I think that we could say that the reason why is because the previous pasuk, what had Yaakov said to Yosef? Menashe and Ephraim are Kiruvin and Shimon. That these two are as dear to me, and significantly that they're going to receive portions in accordance, as if they were one of the original Shvatim. That these two of my grandchildren are going to be as dear to me as my children. Well, once Menashe just got elevated to that he's as close to his grandfather as one of his uncles, that he's as close that he's going to receive a Nachla in Eretz Yisrael, just like his uncles. Then he's on such a high level, he doesn't care that Ephraim got recognized a little more because of a descendant that he's going to have. He doesn't feel that need to compare, because he feels so full, he feels so encouraged by the love that he's just been given. And because of that, we see that Yaakov then goes on to give the brachot, the individual recognition to each of his children, because he's recognized that really what's important in terms of the children feeling that love, feeling that affection, is to have that close connection to the father, the grandfather figure, because that's what's going to prevent any feelings of jealousy, favoritism, unfavoritism, etc. So it's just interesting that I think it's worthwhile to, I saw a U.S. News and World Report piece that says 6 do's and don'ts of favoritism, and I think we can really connect these ideas to some of the concepts that we talked about. So the first one is, explain why you need to spend more time with one child. Could be another child needs help with reading, another child needs help with soccer, another child's going through a rough time with school, you know, with friends in school, whatever it is. It's okay to spend more time with one child or to give more resources to one child, but you should explain it. Kids are old enough, generally, or they are mature enough to understand that not everything needs to be equal to be fair. And if kids grow up with the expectation that things are going to be equal, well, it's pretty much setting them up for a life of disappointment, because life is not equal. But if they can understand that things don't need to be equal to be fair, and things don't need to be equal to feel the love, then they can be positioned in a much stronger way to experience that parent's love. Number two, they say to carve out alone time for each child, to recognize, to do something specific with that child. It could be a short 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there, and it could be different for each child depending on that child's interest. Number three, avoid taking sides for your children, pitting your children against each other. Number four, don't compare your children. Okay? I think that if we compare children, right, why don't you finish your homework like so-and-so? Well, there could be a reason why they don't finish their homework. Maybe they don't finish their homework because They were helping someone else. Maybe that they excel more in chesed. Maybe they don't finish their homework because they were, I don't know, they were coloring the whole homework sheet. They're more creative. Okay, there's lots of reasons, but if we compare them, that goes against specifically number five, right? Focus on each child's unique strengths, which is really what Yaakov did, right? By giving the individual brachot, by focusing on each child's individuality and what makes that person into an individual, that is the clearest way to demonstrate your love and your respect for that child's uniqueness. And the last one is not to compete with a spouse for a child's love or affection, because if a child feels that they're simply a pawn in the parent's, you know, power play, then they feel that the parent is being hypocritical, and they won't be able to accept the love. So I just want to conclude with a short story I just read which in one of Rabbi Yechiel Spiro's books, which I think just shows the extent to which a Rebbe can demonstrate that love for a Talmud. It's a story by Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, the Rosh Shiva of the Mir in Yerushalayim, who on the day of his child's chasana was not coming out. The whole family's ready to go, and he's still inside. He's on the phone, and everyone's waiting. The cab is there. He's honking. Everyone's waiting for him to come, and he doesn't come out. Eventually, one of the children go inside, and he sees that he's on the phone. Now, he may have been on the phone a lot, but it's the day of your son's wedding. Like, now is not the time for somebody to call and start asking you questions about, you know, whatever it is. And eventually he got off the phone. He said, like, what, you know, what was that? And he said that there was one older student in the mirror, the oldest of the students, who was still single. And he wanted to call him that on the day of his child's wedding, that he was thinking of him, that his time will come, that he recognized his child's, he recognized this student's needs. And I think that just kind of goes to show some of those themes, that with whatever it is that you're going on with one child, to recognize that every child has their own needs, their own strengths, and that, of course, on the day of somebody's wedding, they're going to get most of the attention, and people understand that, and that's fine. But to go out of your way to recognize that person's interest and that person's strengths goes and shows that you really care about that person, and that's the love that's going to take them on to the next level. And so maybe we just be zocha that we each have the wisdom and the love to give to each child what their needs are, to provide them with that, you know, that crucial parent relationship, which ultimately for the child really is what models for them that relationship which they ultimately are going to have with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yeah. Have a lovely day.